Welcome to It's All Journalism. My name is Michael O'Connell. On the phone with me today is Ben Wickler. Ben Wickler is always looking for a good fight. Ben's the Washington director of Move On, the political advocacy group. He's also the host of the Good Fight podcast. How's it going, Ben?
It's going great. Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, no, this is great. It's been long overdue. We spoke at the end of 2013. You were on the podcast, and we talked about your time at The Onion, your work with Al Franken, and your first podcasting efforts with Aaron Swartz. So it's what have you been up to in that time? Let's start out with Move On. What has Move On been up to?
So Move On is the sponsor and partner of the show. They very generously offered to cover our first year's budget, with the idea being during that time we would have enough runway to build an audience and get going so that we could raise our own budget for year two. So we're just entering year two. And during the last year, I've both worked with Move On to help create and distribute the show, but I also took on, as you mentioned, the second job as Move On's Washington director. That started in September. Now, in September, it was one of the darkest political moments for Democrats like me because we were leading up to 2014, the midterm elections, which were a total disaster. And so I spent a couple of months kind of in the trenches, trying to organize Move On members and grassroots progressives to turn out to the vote. We hit all of our internal goals. We made 7 million phone calls to people who we wanted to encourage to vote. We raised enough money to put ads on the air in states like Colorado and Iowa. But on Election Day, we lost it all. It was pretty much a clean sweep by Republicans. And these weren't just any Republicans. These were some of the most conservative members, new members of Congress that we've ever seen. So that was a pretty bleak moment. But in October, before the election, I was asked to start working on a special project, which was to map out, if we were to do it, what would it look like to launch a campaign to try to urge Elizabeth Warren to run for president? This was, when we were asking our members what they thought of the 2016 presidential race, we heard, first of all, that they really wanted a contested Democratic primary. They thought that would be better for the country and for the progressive movement to have a debate about the issues facing the country, no matter who the nominee becomes. They thought, that person would be stronger having gone through a real primary. And secondly, they love Elizabeth Warren. They love her fighting spirit, her, both her warmth and her brilliance and her conviction. She just lights up Move On members across the country. So we started mapping this out, and shortly after the election, I guess a month after, we put it to a vote of our members, and 81.3% voted yes, let's launch this. So I've been kind of flat out during my Move On hours, which is most of my time, working on this campaign. We've launched opened offices in New Hampshire and in Iowa. We've got 243 house parties coming up this Saturday, tomorrow, across the country. You can find them at moveon.org, where people are organizing local events to get the word out about Elizabeth Warren and how she should run for president. So that's been really exciting. It's taken off like a rocket ship.
So what do you see then as on the horizon for Move On over the next year, beyond this weekend? What things are you sort of planned?
So one big part will be this effort to encourage Senator Warren to throw her hat in the ring. Until she decides to run, our basic plan is to build the foundation for a campaign so that if she throws her hat in the ring, she will be a viable candidate from day one. That means organizing across the country, finding people who can volunteers, who can go out and knock on doors, raising money, doing polling and message testing to both find out if her message resonates the way we think it does. And every time we've looked, what we found is that what she has to say about the economy, making sure everyone has a fighting chance, that is a message that actually resonates not just with, hardcore progressives like me, but across the board. She has more appeal to Republicans than almost anyone in Washington might expect. And I think once that's loud and clear, even if she doesn't run or even if she doesn't win, I think it can help open the door for a different kind of politics in 2016. So that's focus number one. Focus number two is that we have this new Republican Senate and Republican House, and they are planning to lay down the gauntlet on just about every issue. They're trying to end the FCC's ability to issue net neutrality rules. They want to dismantle Obamacare. They want to dismantle the president's executive action on immigration, all these different issues. And we just expect a series of kind of toe-to-toe political battles in D.C. that need to be won through mobilization around the country. Our members are ready to do that. And then the third thing, which we always do, is support Move On members with whatever campaigns they believe in, They can start petitions on the MoveOn.org website, and our staff then helps them figure out how to win their campaign. And that ranges everything from, you know, preventing the closing of a local library to, on the subject of education, we had a big campaign in Colorado where some school board members tried to remove evolution and distort history in the textbooks, and students rose up against it, started a petition. We helped them turn it into a national story, and it looks like they're going to win that fight.
Okay. Well, this is a journalism podcast. It's not a political podcast, but I think it's important for us to sort of get an idea where you're coming from. And when we start talking about the podcast, you know, get an idea of, you know, what that role plays in what you do, but also, you know, how it helps the Move On mission in a larger sense, how it helps you advocate for people and the David and Goliath battles that you like to get involved in. So how does the good fight fit into all this, or how has it over the last year?
It's a great question. And I should say, you know, you can probably hear the enthusiasm in my voice. I love the things that I feel like are battles for justice. I just love being involved in movements that really matter to people's lives, where, you know, people are getting together to try to make something better. And for me, that's always been part of the vision of the show. Both that the show could be involved in those fights, but also that the excitement that those kinds of fights stir up in me, I think that if we tell the stories of those fights in the right way, they become incredibly interesting stories. And so with The Good Fight, we look for stories that have, you know, drama, that have real emotional power, that can connect people, that have interesting protagonists, the people at the center of the battles, have interesting life stories. And then we try to tell those stories with all the, you know, the ups and downs and energy and uncertainty that people who live those battles actually experience in the course of them. That's kind of the vision of the show. For the first year working on The Good Fight, it was both thrilling to have a show that was taking off and finding an audience, but it was also kind of hard because, you know, as much as I love people and I love being out in the world, making a podcast like The Good Fight, which is, you know, aspires to kind of this American life style documentary storytelling, it involves a lot of time sitting in a room, listening to the same, you know, chunks of sound over and over on your computer as you, you know, remove the ums and think about where to add music. And so actually having these two hats to wear has been fantastic. Now I go to a, you know, a meeting with an ally and start plotting out political strategy. And then during the coffee break, I say, hey, could I interview you for the show? I think this would be a great story for the podcast. They work together really well.
So are there any particular stories that you told over the last year that you thought were particularly powerful or took you on journeys maybe even that you didn't expect?
You know, there's two that spring to mind immediately. The first is this summer, we did an episode with Larry Lessig, who's the Harvard Law professor. He became a national kind of intellectual celebrity for his work on copyright and internet law, making the case that our copyright system was completely tilted towards the interests of people who make stuff, who make content the first time, but kind of values their control over the benefit to the public if people can reuse and remix the material, including things like, you know, books that essentially nobody reads, but someone still has a copyright on them because they were published 60 years ago. Those things should be in the public domain for people to remix and reuse. So he led this big fight for years, and in the course of that, made friends with Aaron Swartz, who was my co-founder of the show, when Aaron was a kid. And Aaron, I think, was 20 or 21, and had this conversation that changed Larry's life. He said, look, Larry, you know, your speeches and books are great, but you're never going to win this battle on copyright unless you change the whole political system, the way money plays a role in politics. And Larry wound up kind of abandoning his old life and totally changing his focus. And so I did a show about that story, about that transformation that led through Aaron's passing 2 years ago, and then led up to this kind of tilting at windmills quest that he's on now, where he created something called the May Day Super PAC. He's launched something called the New Hampshire Rebellion in New Hampshire, where he marches across the state every year, starting on Aaron's birthday, the day of Aaron's death. And it told that story of how he used his grief about Aaron, and he channeled that into a shoot the moon, but pretty, you know, bold and inspiring strategy to try to root out the corruption infecting our political system. And I went back to Larry twice after that first episode where I told that story to get updates on how it was going and what's next. that was exciting for me to tell a story that unfolded over time, and also something that was so, you know, so public, but also so personal.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of my favorite episodes.
And you said there was another one that
yeah.
came to mind?
So the second one that comes to mind is the story of Zach Walls. He's a guy, you might not know his name, but you've probably seen him on YouTube. A couple years ago, there was a link that exploded across the internet under the headline, "Two Lesbians Had a Baby and This Is What They Got." And if you click that, you saw this Eagle Scout in a suit who was 18 years old, maybe 19, testifying to the Iowa State Legislature about marriage equality. He had the state legislature was considering a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage, and he was testifying that they shouldn't do that. And he said, "I have two moms, and no one I've ever met has ever guessed that I had gay parents, because you know my family's just like any other family. I'm an Eagle Scout. I'm a small business owner. I'm a college student, and there's no way in which having moms of the same gender has affected my life in a negative way."
Mm-hmm.
And his speech was so powerful that it wound up getting viewed like 15, 16 million times on YouTube as one of the most viral political videos. So he became famous, and then he turned around and led this campaign to get the Boy Scouts to end the ban on gay scouts.
Mm-hmm.
And he's fighting to end the ban on gay scout leaders. And to me, what was so cool was first his overcoming, as he told me on the show, which I hadn't realized, when he was a kid, he was terrified of telling anyone about his family. He would lie about it.
Mm-hmm.
But he completely overcame that and became kind of the face of a new kind of family. And then he turned around and challenged an institution that was, you know, maybe second only to his parents in its formative effect on his character, which is the Boy Scouts, and actually won at least half of a giant fight there. So we told kind of the stories of those two fights in his life in an episode that My granddad, who's 92, listened to it and told me afterwards that he had tears in his eyes at a couple of moments. It was, you know, Zach really dug deep and opened up about what it felt like to go through that journey, and I'm really proud that we could share that with our listeners.
Wow. That's just sort of amazing, the power of the types of stories you can tell with podcasting. You're a huge advocate of podcasting. What is it you like about this medium?
I love the intimacy of podcasts. More than any other medium, podcasts, you know, are like direct communication between people. It's someone's voice in your ears, often in your earbuds. It's just you and whoever's speaking. People listen to podcasts, you know, when they're exercising or doing chores or in the shower or
in the car,
alone in their cars. Yeah. At times when, you know, there's no one else around and you can get close. You feel like, you know, someone. It's not, television's kind of a cold medium where you're far away from somebody who's clearly in a different place. Podcasting, it's really like they're whispering in your ear right next to you.
Yeah.
I love that, and I love the space that you get. When Aaron and I started working on what became The Good Fight, we had this big decision to make, and at first, we wanted to make a YouTube show. YouTube was exploding. It's still exploding. There's a whole generation that consumes a ton of their media on YouTube. But as we worked on it, we just kept running into this wall, which is that YouTube videos have to be really short, and the most powerful stories take some time to unfold. And in our society, it's so rare to have anything where you can actually spend, you know, 20 minutes, half an hour, even longer than that with someone on a single idea and still have their attention and their trust. And that to me is just an extraordinary gift for our listeners to be able to have that kind of time and attention. And it's an extraordinary opportunity to go to places that are impossible to go in the space of a 3-minute viral video.
Yeah. I think audio is a much more personal medium. Clearly, one of the problems with like doing YouTube, you know, you said that it, you know, needs to be real short, 2-3 minutes. But the other thing is it has to be visually compelling. And you can even see that when people who do podcasts online, it's just showing two people talking, you know, unless those people are really interesting looking or they're doing kind of something interesting, the video aspect of it isn't giving you necessarily any real added value. Strength of podcasting is the intimacy of it. The fact that it's your companion when you're alone and it's talking directly to you and telling you that story. I think that's one of the things I really like about it in the podcast that I listen to, but also, you know, in doing this as well, in having conversations with people and sort of tapping into their brain.
That is so right. You know, one of the things that I learned when I was, you know, taking a run at doing a YouTube show, and don't get me wrong, maybe I'll try that eventually. We made a video for the Kickstarter that we're doing for The Good Fight. It was a lot of fun, but I kept not working. So I asked somebody who'd made a bunch of successful videos, and they said, "Ben, first thing you got to know is that you need to have some kind of like big visual change, a jump cut, introducing some kind of prop. Something crazy has to happen on the screen every 3 seconds,
yeah,
or you're going to lose your audience." That drove home to me, you know, with video, there's a level of artifice. You have to constantly contrive these changes that is you just don't do in radio. In fact, it's bad in radio. In radio, in audio, in podcasting, you want to give someone the experience of actually being there with you for a conversation. It's much more human and natural. It's authentic in a way that the video, good video just kind of can't be, because video requires so much craft in order to, you know, not bore people to tears.
Yeah, authenticity, I think, is the word that you said that sort of this sort of hangs on, is that, you know, people sense in conversation when somebody's being truthful or that they're saying something. It's, you know, our conversation is one of our oldest means of communication. It's the one that, you know, the first thing that we learn, that, you know, how to speak to our parents and try to communicate with the world and use words. So, you know, I think we're just programmed to, you know, accept this information in that way, in a much more intimate and powerful way. So you launched The Good Fight to much acclaim. It shot up on the iTunes rankings. You had Al Franken on, your friend Al Franken, I should say. So what was that experience like?
So that was amazing. That was kind of staggering. When we launched, So before The Good Fight, I had a show called The Flaming Sword of Justice.
Which is the best name ever for a podcast, and one day we're going to steal it. I'm just giving you, if it's missing, then that's where it's going to be. I just want to give you a heads up.
But I appreciate it. I have to tell you, I love that name. So many people were so confused by that name. They thought it was a gay thing because it had the word flaming. They thought it was a Renaissance fair, like, you know, J.R.R. Tolkien thing because of the sword. They thought it was a biblical thing. It turns out that flaming swords of justice actually appear in the Bible.
D&D thing.
Yeah. and for me, it probably came from D&D. I love D&D. I had actually pitched that name to Al Franken. My first job out of college was producing Al Franken's radio show, and I had tried to get him to call his show The Flaming Sword of Justice, but instead he went with the name The O'Franken Factor. And when people asked him why, he said, "For one reason and one reason alone, to annoy and bait Bill O'Reilly. Bill, please sue us. Please, please sue us."
Yeah, that man has good comic sense.
He sure does. So he eventually became The Al Franken Show, which was a little sad, but, you know, a joke had run its course. So I had The Flaming Sword of Justice. That show was kind of my starter experience.
Your proto show.
My proto show, and there was so much I didn't understand. And when my wife got a job in D.C., we had to kind of wind down that show. We moved here, and I started talking to people in the podcasting field about how they did it. I talked to Alex Bloomberg. I talked to Andy Bowers, who runs the Slate operation, the podcast operation at Slate, and I asked for their advice. And the first thing I learned is all of the action is on iTunes. I'd been trying to get people to go to my website, but they said, no. Like 90% of podcast listening happens on iTunes. You need to get people to iTunes. And the second thing they said is, you know, you have this, or actually this came from MoveOn.org, which is sponsoring the show. They said, look, you know, we're providing the funding, we're paying your salary, but the real asset we have is our millions of members who subscribe by email.
Right.
And so, you know, you should email them about the show, which made a lot of sense when you thought about it. And the third thing was, when you email people, people open their emails at all different times. I had been doing The Flaming Sword of Justice as live radio and then post the podcast afterwards.
What are you, crazy?
It was, not a good strategy. So you want to make something people can listen to at any time, which is the direction that all media is really going, on-demand TV and, you know,
right.
Obviously, the internet, it doesn't matter what's in the daily newspaper, it's what's online. And if it's online, that means that you can release it when it's ready. It means it can be the length that's appropriate to the content as opposed to it being a fixed length format. And it means that you can edit, which means that if you have a bad interview, you don't have to release it. If there's, you know, a siren going by, you can cut that part out. And what I, you know, heard from all these podcast pros is pretty much every show that I liked had some, you know, some real attention paid to the editing.
Yeah.
And so I had this spreadsheet where I was projecting, you know, what the potential audience growth was and how fast to get to how many listens. And I started fiddling with the numbers and realized that if I made it much, much less often, I'd have the potential to grow much, much faster if the show was better.
Wow.
And that was the strategy. So when we launched, at first it was every week, which in retrospect was too ambitious for what we were trying to do with the resources we had. But it was still a lot less than 5 days a week, which is what I had been trying to do.
Yeah.
And
to be young and naive.
I mean, not that it was too much fun to be hurtling along at that breakneck pace. But we started putting real work into it, and then I worked really hard on the emails that would make the case and intrigue people to try to listen to the show. And mm-hmm. we released our first episode. We emailed the whole MoveOn list, and within a few days, it was the number one podcast on iTunes. Just for a few days, but for 2 days, we beat out This American Life, and touched the Holy Grail. And I was just could not believe it. I couldn't believe that my show, this show that had been so tiny so recently,
right,
was actually out there in the world.
Yeah, now that is I can only imagine it's an incredible experience. I like the fact that you sort of realize that quality and when people listen are so important. The thing that I've had people that I've talked to about audio and about podcasting is that it's really long tail. That you'll get a bump when you release, but people you said it yourself that people are going to listen to it whenever. And so if you create a quality product that's accessible to people, and market it out, people will find it and it'll sort of grow that way.
It's absolutely right. And it just means a whole different mindset from, I think, the place where a lot of journalists reside. When I was doing The Daily Show, as when I was doing The Al Franken Show, a decade ago, something would happen in the news and I would say, we've got to figure out our take on this story. Yeah, we've got to jump on this and come up with the best interview we can as fast as we can and get it out there.
Yeah.
Because it felt like, being right in the moment of the news cycle was all important. But in podcasts, the logic is completely different. It really is not about being first. It's about being best. It's about being as good as you can. And one of the reasons that's important is that when someone finds your show, some friend tells them about it, they hear about it at the party, they browse through iTunes and they come across it, and they like what they hear, they can then go back and listen to the entire back catalog.
Right.
People will tell me that, I just had a friend yesterday told me that he was on a long drive and he did a binge listen of past episodes of The Good Fight.
Yeah.
And if those episodes were kind of reacting to breaking news of the day, they just wouldn't be interesting a year later. We now look for evergreen stories. We look for, principles and ideas and emotions that can resonate anytime. And that's a very different type of thing to look for. And frankly, it's a more human rewarding thing to look for than trying to, figure out some novel angle on a piece of news that seems important at the moment but becomes minutiae a month later.
Yeah, we just did an interview with Melissa Bell from Vox.com, which we're going to be posting in a week or so. And something she sort of said was sort of ties into this. I think the thinking of news, of content online is sort of evolving. That I think when when journalists originally come to the digital space, they can immediately identify, we'll be able to get our information out there quickly to a lot of people. And so speed is sort of the driving factor and breaking news is sort of the driving factor. But the fact is that people's relationship with content online is evolving. Like you said, they go back and find older stuff and binge listen, or they actually spend some time on long form where people were sort of downplaying long form because, we want to make sure we get it short so that people can digest it quickly and get the latest news. I think there's a hunger and there's a need for breaking news. I think people are always going to want that. But I think there's, as people become more, intelligent consumers and are seeking quality content, that they're willing to listen longer. I mean, we've mentioned a couple of times on the podcast, one of my favorite podcasts is Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. He releases it once every 4 months. It's 3.5 hours long. I mean, Jesus Christ. I mean, it's fascinating to listen to. People do that. People listen to a book on tape because it interests them. And that's really what it comes down to, is creating interesting content.
It's so funny because there's all this talk about, we're in the distraction era. We all have digital ADD. Attention spans are shorter and shorter and shorter. And believe me when I say my distractibility index is as high as anybody's. I am a nightmare. But I can stay focused on something if it's interesting.
Yeah.
You know, I can read a long book if it's a page turner. I can listen to a really long podcast if it's really interesting content. And I think what the distraction era really means, what the digital ADD curse actually means, is that things just have to be better in order to hold people's attention.
Yeah.
There's no reason to sit through something that's a slog. I mean, you know, sometimes you have to for work or what have you, but really we can choose from this incredible banquet. It's not just three channels we can tune into. It's not even 100. We can choose from the very best things humanity has ever created. And that means that both as consumers of news and journalism and audio and podcasts, we all luck out. And then also as creators, it's on us to find, you know, to do something well. It's not enough to do it a lot.
Yeah. I agree. Well, before we wrap up here, I do want to talk about your Kickstarter. It's one of the fascinating things that I think every podcaster sort of deals with is, you know, am I going to do this for free? Am I going to try to make money? You know, how can I create something to sustain this? I mean, this was part of your mission from the beginning, is that you were going to go out and try to find funding. So tell us about the Kickstarter.
Sure. So, you know, again, I had this great set up with MoveOn, who took a risk on the show, and they covered our costs for the first year. And then now that I have two hats, my salary is actually paid by MoveOn.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a staff. I have a full-time associate producer, a production coordinator who manages operations and a whole bunch of other stuff, and then a halftime executive producer who lives in North Carolina and is a great public radio vet. And so the Kickstarter is to pay them, which is the, like, you know, core necessity to keep the show going. And what we're trying to do is raise $100,000. We have 6 days left. We have $50,000 to go. So if we can raise the next $50,000 from listeners in, you know, small chunks and big chunks, that unlocks the rest of the funds, and we will be, you know, we'll make payroll next month. It's kind of a high-stakes gamble, but it's also really exciting. It's exciting both because in the course of it, I've gotten to kind of tell the story of the show. We have a video. It's pretty good for the first 3 minutes, and then we have a fake ending, and then it goes crazy. So if anyone out there is interested in, I think, a pretty fun experience, I've never had anyone see the whole video and come back to me with anything less than enthusiasm. And there's a surprise cameo by someone at the end that a lot of folks enjoy. You can check that out at thegoodfight.fm/KS for Kickstarter. The chance to show folks that video, and then to, you know, be able to engage with all the people I've known throughout my life and tell them why I'm doing this and what it's about, has been wonderful. And I've been floored and really humbled by a lot of people coming out of the woodwork to kind of invest in this vision for a show that tells stories of fights that matter in a way that brings people in. That's just been really a thrill. And if we cross the finish line, which I'm confident we'll do, I hope we'll do it. I have a lot of work to do to make sure we do, then it'll feel really great because I have a baby due 2 weeks after the Kickstarter ends.
Oh my gosh. Congratulations. Yeah. I think the last time we spoke, you had your child was quite young, but it's soon to have another one. Congratulations on that. Congratulations on the ongoing success of the Good Fight. So once again, what's the website? How can people contribute?
Go to thegoodfight.fm or thegoodfight.fm/KS, which will take you directly to the Kickstarter page. Check out the video. Even if you're on the fence or even if you think you don't want to give to the project, I do encourage folks to check out the video, especially the second half. It's a lot of fun.
Okay.
And if you do contribute, you will get what we call the headphone splitter of justice, which is the progeny of the Flaming Sword of Justice. It's a slingshot-shaped headphone splitter, where if you pull off the bottom, you can plug it into your phone, and then you can plug in two sets of headphones and share The Good Fight or It's All Journalism with a loved one.
Okay. I was a little concerned that maybe you were arming your backers with, which could be good, could be bad, might be dangerous. So people contribute to this. The Good Fight goes on. What do you see? You know, what are the windmills that you want to go after? What are the Dave and Goliath battles you want to fight the next year?
Alex Bloomberg told me something that Jonah Peretti, the founder of BuzzFeed, told him, which has just been echoing in my mind. He said that every presidential election mints a new media format and a new outlet.
Oh.
And this suddenly snapped into focus when serial took off this fall. There's been this longstanding prediction that radio audiences were going to move online. 9 in 10 Americans listen to podcasts. 9 in 10 Americans listen to radio every week. But so far, it's only been, 1 in 5 Americans listen to podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
And with the rise of smartphones, we can all listen on our phones. With the rise of connected cars, with the rise of high-speed data plans all over the place, it's become really easy to listen to podcasts where it used to be really hard. So everyone has been saying there would be a boom in podcast audiences. But then suddenly, this fall, thanks to Serial, it happened. Serial, out of the box, had a bigger audience than most TV shows. And there are now suddenly millions of people who are looking for new audio to listen to. And Serial also demonstrated a kind of richly textured serial nonfiction storytelling, which takes an unspeakable amount of work, but makes for just fascinating content, especially when you don't know what's going to happen next. And so my dream, and it'll take more than our Kickstarter to have the resources to do it right, but the Kickstarter is the crucial first step. My dream is to actually cover the 2016 presidential race in serial-inspired style, to take people inside this battle for to become the most powerful person in the world, to determine the direction of the country and the whole planet, and to take people inside of that with kind of richly crafted, emotional radio storytelling, and be able to do that for the next couple of years. I think that if we can do that, we have a chance to kind of shake up the way political journalism works and demonstrate the power of podcasting, potentially as a really rich, powerful, deep way to understand one of the most interesting stories in the world. And that is the thing that, wakes me up in the morning. Seizing that, grabbing that brass ring would just be extraordinary.
Wow. If that does not inspire you to give, not that this is a telethon or anything like that, but I hope that the Kickstarter goes through and that you're able to pursue your dream, because you've been doing a pretty good job so far as far as I can see, just moving forward on these ideas that you have and starting new things. So, like I said, good luck with the Kickstarter. Love the good fight, and keep fighting.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to join you.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of digital news. Find more info on us and download other episodes at itsalljournalism.com. This podcast is produced in partnership with the Association of Alternative News Media. Thanks for listening.